Hello and welcome to the first episode of the XPRIZE Cars podcast. I'm Eric Boyd, and today I bring you an interview with Aaron Davenport of Tilting Vehicles Australia. We met up at the Detroit Auto Show in Detroit, and we had a meeting on the third floor just outside the big gallery of cars, and we talked about the tilting vehicle that their team is attempting to build. It's narrow and light and aerodynamic, and they figure that even with a regular gasoline engine, it'll achieve 100 miles per gallon or better. So without further ado, here comes the interview with Aaron Davenport. As it starts, I had just questioned him about an image he showed me of a four-wheel enclosed vehicle. So he explains where that image came from, and then the interview is off and running.
It's a design that we got from somebody that we partnered with for the competition, Matias Furtado. Mm-hmm. He's our artistic and body designer. And this is the rendering that he had currently with a four-wheel design. We're going to build a three-wheel version for the race, because once you go to four-wheel, it doesn't matter how many people it seats, it's a car. And then you got to...
Yeah, pass safety tests and all this.
And that doesn't mean we don't want to do that. We want to build that car. We think that that'll impress more people than the three-wheel version, but it's a little bit further down our development line just because of cost.
Yeah, I agree. So, I looked on your website at the tilting stuff, and it does seem like you have an interesting idea where the driver controls the tilt rather than controlling the angle of the wheels, right? Yeah, that's clever.
Yeah, there's some kind of some drive-by-wire going on there, but basically what it amounts to is that when you're on a motorcycle, and all these vehicles that tilt, no matter how they do it, you kind of think of them as a virtual motorcycle. And if you imagine a motorcycle, the reason why you counter-steer is to affect your tilt. You're going in a straight line, you want to turn right, what you do is you push the handlebars to the left. And because of all the gyroscopic precession, it really doesn't move very far left at all. But what happens is, the track turns to the left, it sucks the bottom of the vehicle out, the top turns right, and then the wheel comes back around, and everything else it kind of does itself. It goes around the corner to that direction. So our concept was, we looked at nature and saw all the things in nature that tilt to turn. You know, it's the most efficient way to go. You can look at studies like, why did geese fly in a V, you know, and you do boards and boards and boards of aerodynamic calculations and finally figure out that that's the most efficient format, you know, the most formation to fly. Like, okay, I guess they learned that over millions of years. So, you know, vehicles turn, tilt to turn as well, and that's why we wanted to do it also. But we thought, take a motorcycle footprint, roughly, a little bit bigger, and what if, once you add a third wheel, you have a way to control your tilt that's not counter-steering. So now that we can control our tilt, now what we can do with the rest of the controls. So then we kind of delved into, okay, we need to counter-steer because it really accelerates your tilt. If you don't counter-steer, you're tilting like this over one point on the ground, and you have a lot of mass moving, so it's a lot of rotational inertia. If you do counter-steer, you're tilting like this, so you can tilt very, very fast. This is what Carver does. They steer, and the hydraulic ram goes, then you want to go that way,
yeah,
or shoves the vehicle over. And they've tweaked a couple other things to try to make it work better or whatever, but that's where they grew from. So we incorporated counter-steering because of that, because it makes you tilt faster. And in a tilting vehicle, if you can tilt faster, you can turn faster, which means you can avoid things and you're safer. Secondly, the other problem with motorcycle-like vehicles is that you get into a situation where you skid and slide and re-grip or just get sideways for whatever reason.
Yeah, and it's so hard to control.
You're going to high side. So the vehicle automatically steers out of a skid as well, so that should you start to get sideways, it immediately relieves that overturning torque on the front of the car, which turns the car right back around so that you're pointing in the direction you're going again. Now, granted, that means if you're sliding off the road, you're going to be going off head first in that direction, but at least you're not going over on your side skidding that direction. So it does as much as technologically possible to keep you on your wheels in control of the situation, so that, you know, any other motorcycle, you get in a position where you lose your traction going around a corner, or you slow down but you couldn't put your feet down for some reason, you're going to tip over, and then, you know, the story's over. Here, what we've basically done is said, let's keep the driver in control of their tilt angle, keep them upright as long as possible, whether they got traction or not, so that when they do get traction back, because it'll eventually happen, they can move off and be safe.
So, that's cool.
You know, it all boils down to, when you're narrower, you're by definition lighter because you've got less material. And you obviously can be a lot narrower if you tilt than you can if you don't.
Mm-hmm.
So once you're narrower, you're then lighter. You're also, by definition, have less frontal area, so your drag goes down. A narrower, same-length vehicle has less coefficient of drag as well, so we kind of lose drag on two fronts, whether we're streamlined or not. And then being lighter lowers your rolling resistance. So that's like four of the five things that affect your efficiency right there. And once you've lowered all four of those, you can use a smaller, more efficient engine and still get the same performance as something that was used a larger engine when it started, you know, before this morphing process. And, you know, that kind of gets us where we're going. One of the things that we looked at was from 1980 to 85, there was a motorcycle competition called the Craig Vedder Efficiency Challenge. And what they did was, he had been designing motorcycles since 1960 or so, and he looked at it and said, in 1960 when I started, motorcycles were getting 35 miles per gallon and cars were getting 10. 20 years later, in 1980, cars were getting 30 miles per gallon and bikes were still getting 35. He's like, where's our advantage? What happened there? And so he realized that it all came down to aerodynamics. Motorcycles, even though they're very small footprint, have terrible aerodynamics. You know, they're flat on the background, a lot of suction drag. And so he's built a streamlined shape to run his bike, changed his position from sitting up to sitting back, put his feet forward.
Overcombed it.
Yeah, and then he streamlined it, and then he cut out a whole bunch of holes in the side of it for putting his feet down and seeing and things like that. And, you know, he kind of commented that making it safe really destroys a nice aerodynamic shape. And then on his first run with 125cc, or either 125 or 250cc motorcycle, he got 120 miles per gallon, somewhere in there. And that's at highway speed. He actually looked at the Shell Eco Marathon and said, wow, 1,000 miles per gallon, how do we get that? And then he looked closer and realized they're doing it at like 5 miles an hour.
Oh, yeah, you know, they run at like 10 miles per hour and they're like this.
Right. So they're unrealistic. He wanted to do it with a real motorcycle at real highway speeds. And I don't know what other rules he had as far as acceleration or anything like that, but basically that's where they started. And then over the next 5 years, from then till 1985, on the last year, they had a vehicle that still had a place to stick your feet out and stop tipping over that got 470 miles per gallon.
Wow.
Still using 125cc engine. It was geared up because it had less resistance at highway speed. It was very fair, and it basically just had a hole for the driver to poke his head out, you know, and see. And little ports that flapped open for his feet to go down. But he did all kinds of things, like he changed the oil on the chain, really lightweight oil, and then same thing in the engine, and probably some things that would make the engine not very last like very long, but you know, it worked for the race. But in that same year, they also had a two-up competition that required that the passenger and the driver have a normal motorcycle posture, which means they had to sit like this. They couldn't be tucked over in a racing tuck or anything like that. And that vehicle got 140 miles per gallon, so...
What was this race called again?
Craig Vedder Efficiency Challenge. If you look at Vedder, V-E-T-T-E-R, if you Google them up, you'll find it. Yeah. They've got all sorts of information on their site. But so that's why we weren't as concerned with the drivetrain up front, because you know, all of our technology is based off of allowing you to be very narrow. You know, you could be sort of narrow as long as you're really low, but that's not safe. You know, who wants to come around a corner and be staring right at the bumper of the SUV that's coming the other way? There's a lot of data that says if you're up at relatively the same height as other drivers, you're more visible first off, you can see a lot better secondly, and if you do get in an accident, the bumper, if it hits below your side, below your ribs, there's a lot less damage to the person involved, you know. And then a lot of people look at our vehicle and go, oh, how safe can that be? I said, well, I don't know, how safe can a dragster or a sprint car be? You know, those cars do multiple end over fantastic, you know, terrible crashes all the time, and the driver goes click click and walks away. You know, so it's not the size of the vehicle itself that's unsafe, it's how you build it. You know, auto manufacturers are in this, just put more steel on it and leave more crunch zone and they'll be safe, which is true. You know, it's the easy way out.
Yeah, it's the sledgehammer mode though,
right?
Yeah.
Right, you know, but I think that for this whole competition, for all these vehicles, you know, Aptera and all them included, that when we start building very lightweight vehicles, very efficient, then we have to look at the racing world and learn what they've been teaching us for the last 20, 30 years. You know, there's a way to build it to be safe without being heavy, and it's not necessarily super expensive. If you're going to build one at a time, yeah, it's probably expensive, you know. But if you're going to build a couple thousand a year, yeah, that's not so bad.
So have you done any calculations on the aerodynamics of yours, what you were expecting to get? Or?
No, because actually Mateus came onto the team late, so we haven't had a chance to run any fluid dynamics on his design yet. We had some other ideas, but we're going to see if we can find some resources to do that. In fact, I think there was a reference on the XPRIZE blog or the forum, from a company that was offering CAD and finite element analysis and that kind of stuff free to small XPRIZE teams and negotiably free to larger XPRIZE teams.
Okay.
So hopefully we can hook up with somebody like that and get some of that work done.
The other thing you could do is just build it and find out, right?
Well, you know, that's what we're doing in the meanwhile. We're going to build it, and we've looked up, you know, ways to find out what the drag is. And really, it amounts to a coast down test. What you do is you say, I know what my mass is. I know how long it took me to go from 60 miles an hour to 50. And there's an easy formula to plug in and figure that out. Now, it includes things like rolling resistance and stuff, so it's not just your aerodynamic drag. So it would be a very conservative number for aero drag, you know, once you get done. But that's what we're going to do until we find somebody that can say, here's what it should be.
Yeah. And did you see the Aero Civic guy a while ago?
Yes,
yeah. That's how he did it.
Oh, yeah, he does a coast down drag.
Coast down.
Yep, yeah. So it's a kind of a low-tech, cheap, you know, but it's pretty accurate, you know, way to do it.
Well, it's real world too, right? I mean, if you do it on a computer, there's always this question about, well, did I actually...
Absolutely. Well, yeah, even Aptera, you look at them, and their announcements 6 months ago were that they had a drag of 0.07. Now it's 0.11.
Yeah.
You know, that's, you know, it doesn't sound that much when you look at it, but that's like 50% higher. That's a world's higher, you know, in the real world. So it may be that same thing. Maybe on the computer it's 0.07, but on the road it's not.
That's cool. So what's the status of your team right now? I mean, you have guys like everywhere. So how do you work together? I don't even...
Yeah, well, we work together over the internet. You know, that's the only thing that kind of ties us all together, and it's where we found each other in the first place. But there's Philip James, who founded the company in Australia. And he's in the process of gathering components and building chassis and doing sketches. We've kind of been going over some ideas lately for the XPRIZE vehicle. He's also got our development mule there that he uses for testing.
That's the one in the videos on your website?
Yeah, that's the one. And then there's Frank Buckhurst, who's in South Africa, and he's our simulations guy. He kind of got us rolling with shareware or freeware simulation software that has a really good physics engine and has allowed us to do a lot of testing on designs that we weren't quite sure about. And we kind of take it all with a grain of salt, saying, you know, hey, I know this isn't a $100,000 program run by somebody whose job is to do this, so this may be what it does, maybe it isn't, but we can try it at least, you know, and get some ideas of what may or may not happen. And then there's Mateus Furtado in Brazil, who just came on board with this design recently. You know, and the biggest thing about his design is that he was involved in the same group where Philip Frank and I met each other about a year and a half ago or so, or more ago. And he left, and then he did this design for his artistic design class. And we said, okay, you get it. You understand that tilting means narrow, and narrow means tilting. You know, they kind of are tied together. There are a lot of vehicles out there, including we had a team approach us earlier before we got in the XPRIZE. Matter of fact, before we even looked that seriously, that said, hey, we're building a vehicle, and we really want it to tilt. We think it would be this is the core of our technology. We want you to be part of our team. You know, we think that you guys are doing it the right way, and we're going to enter this in the XPRIZE. And we're like, oh, okay, let's go look up the XPRIZE and start reading about that. Well, we said, well, what are you building? Show us. And they said, oh, here's the vehicle, and it was there was a Volkswagen version like this and a couple other ones, but basically what it was is a car that was shaped like a canoe, kind of, that was about an inch and a half off the ground, and then it had the wheels out on stalks that sat up to the side. Just testing any dimensions on it. It was probably 4.5 or 5 feet wide, something like that. You know, and it was four-wheeled, and they wanted the whole thing to tilt like that. And we said, well,
if you're 5 feet wide.
Right. I said, well, why do you want to tilt? And their answer was, well, because it's cool and it's fun and it's a great image and it's, you know, it's all these things that'll sell vehicles for us. And we said, well, you know, that's wonderful and all. I wish you luck, but you don't need us to do that. And, you know, honestly, it's contrary to what the XPRIZE is all about. So, you know, good luck to you, but we're going to go our own way and we're going to enter the competition anyway. So we kind of caught the bug of their enthusiasm and said, let's do this. I think this could be good for us.
So let's talk about the Tango, too. I mean, it's this, like, tall, narrow vehicle that doesn't tilt. I mean, I look at that thing and I just think, oh, my goodness, you're going to flip over. Yeah.
I'm sure, and I thought that, too, I'm sure that that's in their business plan, the reason why they're selling the Tango, whatever they call it, the 600, or the one that they sold first to George Clooney. I shouldn't say sold. They probably gave it to him.
Yeah.
But the one I'm sure that's why they sold or showed that one first, because that one is the one that's the highest end, fastest, whatever. And so by the time they get around to selling the ones that are lower, cheaper vehicles, and people go, oh my God, it's going to tip over, they can go, look at that one, it goes 120 miles an hour, yours only does 80, and that one's never tipped. And then they, you know, kind of is a sobering, you know. But basically what they do is they just say, we need a bunch of batteries, we need a bunch of weight. Well, throw out this lithium idea, let's just make it lead acid, and let's stick them in the floor pan that high off the ground, and it'll hold us down. And originally I read that they had some kind of active management tray system that shifted the batteries from side to side underneath as they turned. You know, so it's kind of like the, it's like the sidecar rider version of, you know, leaning back and forth to go around corners. And I don't know if they do that anymore or not, but I have a feeling that would feel interesting to go like this and feel the whole bottom of the car go shift that way as you're doing it. It's got to be close to half the weight of the vehicle being lead acid down there, and to have that much weight shift any distance sideways, you're going to feel it in your steering. You know, I'm sure it feels fine, but basically they just go with the ballast route. They put as much weight as we can, as low as we can. And
that's interesting, you're right. I'm sure it would feel really... I mean, your suspension would go like... Yeah.
Something's going to happen, you know. I don't know. I mean, if you take a regular diagram of a car with the center of gravity projected out, however far they're, you know, how many G's they're pulling, and then shrink that whole thing down so that they're the width of a tango and the center of gravity comes down with it, the design looks the same scale-wise. It's probably the same angle and whatnot. The only difference is their center of gravity is a lot lower realistically than everything else, and so they're going to have that same situation that really low vehicles have of how safe is it when you're getting hit at the line between the door and your windows, you know, when you get in an accident with somebody else. And they've gone to a lot of trouble to do safety cells and things like that too, like race cars, so they're doing as much as they can. We just think it's the wrong answer to be that low. It's inherently really unsafe, you know.
Not to mention speed bumps now become dangerous to your car, right?
Right. Yeah, no, I have a friend in a Trans Am who bent his rims going over speed bumps in Dallas. And I mean, they have speed bumps that are like that high by, you know, whatever. And he hit him at 65 or something, trying to change lanes where he wasn't supposed to. But still, if he did that in a tango, yikes, yeah. You know. So, yeah, I mean, there's other ways to solve it, but we think that's the wrong way to go. You need to be up eye level with the rest of the drivers. You need to be narrow. And a lot of other guys in Australia and South Africa and in Europe and whatnot, they're way more interested in being narrow. And their reason why is because of traffic filtering. They want to get to a stoplight, pull out the line, and go between all the cars to the front of the light, and then go through when it turns green, which we don't do here. But to them, that's
the reason.
That's the reason to do this, because I'm a motorcycle. I can get in London without paying extra taxes. I can filter through traffic, which means I can get there in 45 minutes instead of 3 hours. You know, that's really important to them. You know? So that's going to be something that's key for us overseas. Here, it's going to be the reason why we can be in HOV lanes and you know, things like that. In California, you can drive on the dashed line.
All the time.
I don't think you're supposed to do it if the traffic isn't stopped or going very slow.
I read the law. It's like 20 miles per hour.
Is that it?
Slower than 20 miles per hour, you can filter between the
okay.
lines.
I've seen lots of cases where everybody's going highway speed and the motorcycle's going at least 20 miles an hour faster than you, you know? Like, ooh, holy cow, you know?
If I swerve, you'd be dead.
Right, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So, it'll have that kind of thing, you know, I don't know how much value that's going to be in the U.S. I think the bigger value is going to be it registers as a motorcycle. There now are DMV tests specifically geared toward three-wheel vehicles. Lots of states are even starting to caveat your license where you have a motorcycle endorsement, but it's a three-wheel motorcycle endorsement. So you maybe can drive one, but not the other. Like the Can-Am Spyder, I asked about that when that came out. And at the dealership, I asked them if you could take your cycle test on that. They said, yeah, but you get a disclaimer saying you only can drive three-wheel vehicles. So that's kind of coming around. And ideally, besides lane filtering, HOV lane stands for high occupancy vehicle. And the reason why they're there is to make a lane that rewards you for putting more people in one vehicle. Or getting what they care about is getting more people in 1 mile of lane traffic. So this vehicle, without changing any driving habits at all, will double the passengers per lane mile. Right now, there's a kind of a reward for driving a high mileage vehicle that, well, okay, if you buy this, we'll let you drive in that lane. Eventually, that's going to change. You know, it's going to get back to, yeah, well, okay, it was nice and all, but either that bar is going to keep moving up, or they're going to say, I'm sorry, the roads are so congested that we can't build more lanes here that we have to call it a real HOV lane now.
Yeah, I don't know if you know the Prius used to qualify for a sticker for the HOV lanes, but in California, that's not lapsed. If you buy a Prius in California, it no longer gets that sticker.
Really?
Yeah. So it's actually hilarious. I saw a study that looked at the value of used Priuses. Turns out the value of one of those stickers is $4,000.
So the sticker goes with the car. If you buy a used one, it has the
car,
sticker.
Exactly. And the markup on Priuses with the sticker is $4,000.
So from one model year to the next, there's a 4,000-year depreciation for the newer vehicle.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, and it's even more than that because it's a 1 year newer vehicle, exactly. So it should be worth more. So,
exactly.
Wow. Yeah. That's interesting. So what does qualify? Anything?
I think some of the other hybrids still do. It's just like the, you know, the federal tax credits, right? I mean, they declined the number made. So the Prius has lapsed out of them way earlier than like the Honda Civic and other things.
So it's based on how many per year they sell?
Yeah.
So it's not only a reward for going high mileage, it's a reward for being first adopters on a new technology, basically.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's clever.
Yeah, so basically our whole core of our idea is reduce everything except for the end technology, and then that kind of follows along. It allows us to pick something cheaper. And we're currently looking for somebody to partner with that has an engine that they want to say, hey, we're in the XPRIZE and we're doing really good too, you know, or whatever. So our drivetrain or a hybrid system, you know, we'll use any of those. That'd be fine. But we're not married to anything right now. We're still looking for partners, so...
Yeah, if you get your efficiency high enough, you could just use gasoline and it'd be fine, right?
Right, yeah, I mean, you know, you look at, obviously, a 1985 motorcycle, fared well, which that is,
mm-hmm.
with a 125cc engine with a few light oil tricks and light springs and things like that, gets up to 470 miles per gallon, you know, and your emissions go with your mileage. If you're getting 200 miles per gallon, your emissions are going to be good enough. I don't care how bad your engine is, you're going to get there. The only other thing you got to worry about is your acceleration, making sure you can get from 0 to 60 under their... I think the cutoff is like 10 seconds or something like that.
Yeah,
it's just... It's all right, you know. It's you know, about like an old Volkswagen or something, but it's not so aggressive that you can't get there with an average engine. You know, we may have to do some either some hydraulic hybriding just for stop and go, or some pneumatic hybriding or something like that, you know, but it's nothing that you can't buy off the shelf.
Yeah, cool. So are you at all worried about the tandem seat stuff? I know in the draft rules they were saying, you know, two seats side by side, and they've made some motions towards relaxing that. Have you heard from them definitively, or...?
Well, it's not definitive in the rules yet, but I think everything that they have in their... I forget what they call it now, the proposed changes document,
I
think pretty much everything in that already has, like, here's what we've been asked, here's what we're leaning toward, and the impression I get is that this is what we're going to say, unless we're convinced otherwise by something very convincing. So it's kind of that's going to be in the rules. So we're not too worried about that. Though it's kind of a bummer that they want to take the alternative class and split it into two subclasses so that they have side-by-side and tandem, you know. When it comes down to it, if it's a two-passenger vehicle, you know, and tandem is much more efficient than sitting side-by-side, then they should let them compete that way. They should let them compete head-to-head and give the prize to whoever wins, and then show all their merits on the stage, so when somebody says, yeah, that's great, but I want the one that did the best that got seated side-by-side, that's the one I want to buy. Great, you know, then that showcases them. I don't think they should split up the prize package between those two classes, though.
Yeah, I guess they're just concerned, like, from a market perception, whether people would be willing to buy tandem seating, and I just have no feel for that.
I'm sure that's what they're thinking too, but I wonder why they would single that out when, from a market perception standpoint, they don't want to get in the way of any other technologies.
Yeah.
You know, they don't want to pick which fuels you can or can't use as long as they're kind of, you know, available. They don't want to, you know, rule any other technologies in or out. They're trying to be technology neutral, so why are they saying you have to sit side by side? You know, I understand the mainstream restrictions that says that it needs to have space and comfort qualities similar to an average car,
mm-hmm.
because that's what it's trying to replace. It's trying to replace the car.
So it's called mainstream, yeah.
Right, and the alternative class should be similar too. It should be similar types of space and saving or, you know, safety features for that size vehicle. But beyond that, you know, why would they want to go into that kind of detail and say that this one's better than this or vice versa? So we'll see. Hopefully we can have some more discussion on that. I did hear when I was here that they're hoping to have the rules finalized by the New York Auto Show, which is in the middle of March. And they're having some online discussions with the teams that they brought on board in the Letter of Intent program, as well as their steering committee, or whatever they call it, advisory board, that helped draft the initial rules to go from where they're at now to the final set of rules. So hopefully in the next 2 months or so they'll have...
Yeah,
the rules more nailed
plan.
Down. And I even got a feel from some of the people I talked to that final will be a draft final, not a final. So they're still moving on that too. You know, they've got people like AFS Trinity that's telling them, those rules don't yield a real vehicle, you know. Whatever his reasons are, he didn't tell me why he thinks that, but maybe, like you said, because he's not counting electricity.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of companies that build their cars that way, they're doing that same thing. If you look at R.Q. Riley's XR3, he's doing the same thing. All his mileages are based off of what if the electricity is free, then what kind of mileage does this get?
Exactly.
Have you looked at that one at all?
I have, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it actually looks pretty cool.
Yeah, it looks great. You know, and honestly, it's supposed to get 125 miles per gallon just on diesel without counting electricity at all. Mm-hmm. So they're, you know, up in that range where they could compete with that vehicle if it meets the numbers that they've calculated. But he's done a lot of these before, so I wouldn't be surprised if it's pretty close. You know, this isn't just a swag guess for him.
I haven't heard. Is he going to enter it himself? Or, I mean, it's a kid car, so anybody could theoretically buy it and, you know, race it.
I haven't heard anything about him entering it yet. You know, I do follow they have a list on Yahoo, and I follow that, and one person on there threw out there, hey, you could put this right in the X Prize and win, you know, $20 million, and I jumped in right behind him and said, well, first off, it has to have four passengers if it's going to win $20 million, so it won't win that, but, yeah, you're right, he could get it in,
yeah,
you know, in the third class, but, yeah, I've heard nothing so far, so who knows, you know, he may be like, you know, the commuter cars and the Aptiras of the world where he's already at the ready-to-sell-it stage and he's not in a hurry to go do much more press. He'd maybe just jump in at the last second to get some exposure.
Yeah, extra exposure.
Yeah, we'll see. I don't know.
Yeah, I've been wondering if there would be, like, is the XPRIZE actually working towards a thing where, you know, the winner may get an automatic contract with some, you know, large government thing or something, right? I mean, it's totally
awesome. Yeah, that'd be great.
That'd be totally awesome.
That might be something to just twist their arm on to see if in their talks with the cities for
hosting stations,
if they could spin something with a city to say, hey, will you buy so many of the winning car to use as rental cars at the airport or something, you know, hey, you can rent this car. And,
or part of your city fleet or...
Yeah, exactly.
Right, for visiting dignitaries.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of cities that use natural gas powered this and hydraulic that and hybrid the other, you know, just for a green image. That's one thing that I think GM really doesn't capitalize on very well is their image. And they're just now, honestly, they let Toyota get way ahead of them in the consumer market, you know. I think it's their third generation hybrid that they're out with right now that they're announcing. And they've been putting most of their hybrid efforts into trucks and buses and larger vehicles instead of the small consumer market. And just the hybrid buses that GM has sold to cities on the West Coast, nowhere else, just the West Coast, just those buses alone save more gas in a year than all the Priuses sold put together.
Yeah.
You know, so as far as environmental impact goes, they're doing a lot better. But as far as advertising and awareness and public opinion and things like that, you know, they haven't been doing so well.
Well, it does make sense. I mean, if you put it in a bigger vehicle, you save a lot more gas net because, you know, you make the same 40% improvement, but the vehicle uses five times as much gas, so you're saving, you know, five times as much.
You know, and those buses are running 20 hours a day, every day. You know? So not only are you making that five times as much, you're making it for three times as long. So do you have any other questions or anything else you're interested in?
No, I think you pretty much wrapped it up. I mean, I guess, are you guys still looking for funding and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, we're still looking for funding. We've got a couple of investors that we're talking to that we're kind of on second or third round discussions with. One of them that we're currently looking at going to a motorcycle and scooter show with soon. Hopefully we'll be able to make an announcement about that if we get something concrete. We also are looking for partnerships for drivetrain. Although, if you go look up that Craig Vetter Efficiency Challenge, we've kind of got that in our back pocket. That should we find nothing really interesting in drivetrain, we can always fall back on just having an efficient small motorcycle scooter engine, and we should be fine. And partnerships for exposure in the race. You know, it's a team who wants to say, I'm involved in being green, and I want to have my name on the side of a vehicle who's in the race. But we don't necessarily sell anything that, you know, deals with cars. You know, that's fine, too, if we can find something like that. You know, be kind of like the NASCAR sponsors that put their name on the hood just so you can see it grow on the track, run, run, run. You know, in a way, we just, we, we're definitely not a big company. We weren't ready to sell, so we're looking for some help.
Cool. In terms of building your prototype, is that going to be in Australia or?
Yeah, so far it is. We want to build a demo vehicle here in the U.S. as well for investors and things to look at. We were talking about that more before the XPRIZE came up, so I don't know now if our plan is going to change on that a little bit based on the XPRIZE. Obviously, the demo vehicle is going to, or the XPRIZE vehicle is going to come here from Australia once it's ready, but Philip's the one who's building it right now. We just had a company who builds custom motorcycles approach us based on the exposure from the auto show here and said, hey, you know, we're here in Michigan and we'd like to work with you and you know, if you give us drawings, we can build whatever you want, and so maybe we'll use them for a demo vehicle.
That's cool.
Another thing we'd like to do is this vehicle really has a lot of the same first impression that the commuter cars does. Oh, that's going to tip right over, you know. What we'd like to do is we'd like to have a demo that people can actually try. We already have a demo on digital on a computer with a steering wheel that you can drive the vehicle and see, okay, if I do this, what does it do kind of thing. We've set up some things called like a yoked test where you have a regular counter-steered vehicle and then a vehicle with this type of control side by side, and when you do something, you can see what they both do different. That way you know they're both getting the same input and what happens to them. We'd also thought about having hiring somebody who builds remote control vehicles to build an RC version of this,
so
that if you don't have to get into insurance issues, you know, over it, you can stand there and hold the controls and drive it around and go, oh, cool, look, I'm power sliding, you know, whatever, and then you try another one and it flips right over. So, you know, maybe we can get something like that going. We definitely know that we have to have a kind of like a hands-on demonstration, look how stable we are kind of, you know, publicity event. You know, we're still working on that. We're willing to do something, but I'm sure insurance companies and things will make some of the decisions for us when it comes down to it.
Okay, well, thanks very much.
Sure, thank you.
And that concludes the interview with Aaron Davenport of Tilting Vehicles Australia. I'm Eric Boyd, and this is the XPRIZE Cars podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening. And if you want to see more details on the Tilting Vehicle Australia or any other XPRIZE car, please check out xprizecars.com.